Hi, friends. Welcome to True Crime with Yvonne Estelle. I'm your host, and we are here for another week, right before the holidays. But that's not what I'm here to talk to you about today. See, you know how they say accidents happen? And while that may be true, what if something that seems like a mistake is actually much more sinister? You know what I mean? Like a person who accidentally bumps into you, but it turns out they don't like you very much. Or if you accidentally miss a call from someone that you've secretly been avoiding. Well, for today's episode, a long-term partner swears he accidentally committed a crime. The question is, does the evidence support that claim? Or something much darker at play? This is the case of Leslie Davidson. Our story begins in Fort Benton, Montana, one of the oldest occupied settlements in Montana, actually. But our case starts in 2009. Fort Benton has a population of less than 2,000 people. That's about a third of my high school. Some of you have more friends on Instagram or Facebook than there are people in Fort Benton. It's a national historic landmark. In the evenings, you can walk along the steamboat levee in a part of town that was once considered the bloodiest block in the West. In 2009, it felt as though history may be repeating itself. When a shooting left 37-year-old Daniel Paulsrud paralyzed in his face. He was shot in the throat, with the bullet moving upwards through the back of his skull. Though painful and violent, with the need of reconstruction surgery done, it wasn't fatal. However, that was a different story for Leslie Davidson, Daniel's girlfriend, who died on the scene. Daniel John Paulsrud wasn't originally from Fort Benton. He was born in Nahart, Montana. I cannot tell you much about Nahart, except that the population is less than Fort Benton, at 43 people. It's a town crouched between the Little Belt Mountains, an area that just seems vast. In some ways, driving through it can be what one would imagine as their way to heaven. Endless skies, green pastures, trees that tower over you. The town itself was known for fly fishing, something Daniel loved to do. It was a small town, obviously. The couple buildings that scattered the area were more like houses, everything local. Daniel was a hunter. He enjoyed playing outside with his friends and spent his days abiding by his family. After finishing high school, Daniel enlisted in the 101st Airborne Division of the U.S. military. He went to Desert Storm and Kuwait. On one hand, it prepared him for life. But there was trauma there, too. He considered the more horrific things he saw was how people there were treated. He was impacted by the brotherhood he built out there. At the time, Daniel was young, blonde, with large, almost innocent-looking eyes. He seemed like your small-town guy exploring and experiencing the world. After leaving the military, Daniel decided to become an artist. He was a creative and spent years in Colorado working on sculptures. It was up until his mid-20s when that no longer was paying the bills, so he decided to move back to Montana to be closer to his family and look for work. That's where he met Leslie. Leslie was a beautiful young woman. She used to sport a short haircut, letting her hair hang right above her ears. She had thick-rimmed glasses and a ski-lope nose. The duration of this episode is going to cover Leslie's relationship with Daniel, but I want you to get to know her as a person before I focus on that. Leslie was born on June 24, 1959. She was actually adopted at the age of 2 by the Appleby family. This is where she ended up growing up in Fort Benton. Leslie played in the band and loved sports. She ran track and played basketball, as well as being on the swim team. Leslie was just an active person. She even held the state high school javelin record. That's the sport where you throw the sphere and see how far of a distance it can go. Which I totally don't mean to mansplain that. I just figure if I didn't really know what it was, there has got to be someone in the audience who needed a quick Google on it as well. Leslie graduated from high school in 1977 and quickly after that married her high school sweetheart, Michael Davidson. The two were determined to make it and really loved each other. They had two children, Amanda and Justin, and stayed locally in Fort Benton. From the early 80s to mid-90s, Leslie worked. She was a claims adjuster. She ended up having a couple more children, Samantha and Kaylee. And during that time, while finding her independence and raising her kids, Leslie learned to enjoy the simple things in life, like bowling or watching movies with her kids and spending time with her brother and sister. Everyone who knew Leslie knew that she was vibrant, friendly. I mean, she was funny, this powerhouse in high school, to becoming a mother and then focusing on having a career. Even her relationship with her first husband, though it ended, the two stayed on decent enough terms. I mean, people just liked Leslie. And honestly, what's not to like? According to Daniel, Leslie was not always the outdoors type. But she was athletic and one of those people who could just kind of pick up on things quickly. And that included camping and hunting. I believe, though, that Leslie was hunting before meeting Daniel, and that Daniel maybe found this as something to bond over, a craft to continue to perfect. So how did the two of them, these knowledgeable gun owners, end up in a situation involving being shot? Especially with Leslie being safety-focused. Leslie and Daniel met and started dating around 2003 or 4. Leslie and Michael had grown apart and decided to divorce in 2001. Shortly after, Michael died due to heart condition issues. Daniel and Leslie met, and the relationship kind of began as a whirlwind. Leslie had all of her children, and with the age difference between the two older ones being pretty much grown adults, the younger ones lived at one point in the town of Nahart with Leslie when she agreed to move there with Daniel. Leslie and her kids had gone from a hometown of 2,000 to less than 45. Pretty isolating. The couple eventually decided to move back to Fort Benton in 2009. By this point, they'd been together for about 6 years and had spent their time going on hunting trips, raising Leslie's two younger daughters, and really trying to find their footing as a new family. But things weren't all smooth sailing, according to Daniel. The couple fought over Leslie's parenting styles. Leslie was also very close with her eldest daughter. Daniel felt that Leslie and Amanda would go out partying, which doesn't necessarily sound right. A woman who spent her career doing insurance claims and enjoyed the simpler things in life wasn't spending her nights hitting the bar, getting wasted with her daughter. Now, maybe she went out every so often with her daughter, occasionally. I mean, she was also an avid bowler, so she was social. Also, Leslie was 50 years old. She knew how to handle herself and take care of herself. Besides, Amanda loved her mom. They liked spending time together. Nevertheless, the tension rose between Amanda and David. Between Amanda and Daniel, which I can only imagine put Leslie in an uncomfortable position. By 2009, Leslie was just happy to be moving back home. It was clear she wasn't staying in Nahart, and Daniel, not wanting to lose her, followed. The couple were getting their home in order, getting things settled just in time for the holidays. And it was Thanksgiving Day in 2009 when everything would come to a screeching halt. There are two versions of the story. There's Daniel's and there's the evidence. I'd like to start with Daniel's. According to him, he and Leslie went hunting right outside of Fort Benton. For those of you who aren't familiar, hunting is an activity that happens very early in the morning, like before the crack of dawn. At the risk of lowering my rating again, I can tell you growing up, my grandfather was an avid hunter in Mississippi. He'd take my dad out, and I can remember being really little, puttering around downstairs in the basement to follow them and eagerly watch as they got ready. putting on their jumpsuits and packing their gear. Sometimes my grandma would make sandwiches for them, or my grandpa would put together something for himself. They'd be gone all morning, and I can't really remember even when they would come back. The anticipation on if they got anything. Most people hunt deer, but depending on the season, you can hunt turkeys and other animals. And in Montana, it was no different. Daniel and Leslie were out, and at some point in the day, Leslie was getting calls from her kids, wondering when she'd be home, for them to, you know, prepare their Thanksgiving plans. The pair decided it was time to go home. Daniel explained that immediately once they were settled in the apartment, Leslie called Amanda, and an argument between the mother and daughter ensued. Daniel explained that he wanted to get out of the way, let Leslie have her conversation in private, and so he went out to the truck to begin to unpack. According to him, when it comes to unpacking, he always unloaded the ammunition from the rifles before bringing the guns in the house. And on that day, he assumed he did. Now, Daniel claims that about an hour and a half go by and that Leslie appears and had brought beer. It isn't clear where she was when she'd left. Now, the home apparently was Leslie's, and Daniel doesn't specify if he knew Leslie had left. But according to him, she was back in the home, which I'm considering an apartment, and so do they, even though it kind of looks like a one-level house. But the evening from then on seemed calm. Daniel and Leslie had dinner together, which it isn't clear where her children were or why they weren't celebrating the holiday together. But apparently, the two drank beers, and Daniel said that they mainly spoke about their future. Casually, on the kitchen table was a .357 Magnum pistol. Now, usually hunters have rifles, but trigger warning here, they will also bring pistols in order to wound an animal. But you don't normally go out with a pistol solely to hunt animals. Daniel says that in the midst of his evening with Leslie, he picked up the pistol and began playing with it. He cocks the pistol, puts it down, cocks it again, puts it down, and the third time he cocks the pistol, it goes off. Leslie was on the other side of it. It was a single bullet that ripped through her chest. Daniel said, quote, "It died. She died so fast." Daniel claims he was in a panic and realized there was nothing more to live for. He went to the refrigerator and got a bottle of vodka and drank it enough to be able to place the pistol to himself and pull the trigger. Daniel claims that he doesn't remember anything after that, other than him being rushed to the hospital. Leslie dies on the scene, and 9 months later, Daniel is charged with the murder of Leslie Davidson. Daniel had a $300,000 bail, and he explained that because he shot himself, authorities believed that it was a murder-suicide, not an accident that followed with Daniel wanting to end his life as well. Daniel, at this point, realized that he lost his future, Leslie's children's world, and that day was the day everything he essentially knew was over. On the day of the shooting, Chief John Turner was the first to arrive on the scene. Chief Turner explains that he and his wife were about to have Thanksgiving dinner when he got a call about an intoxicated injured person. When pulling up to the one-level white house, there was a man in the driveway on all fours, vomiting with blood everywhere. Chief Turner assumed that this was someone who may have had too much to drink for the holiday and had fallen. What he hadn't realized was that this was much more of a horrific story. And that vomit wasn't vomit at all. It was blood spouting everywhere. The chief asked the man what happened. Another man, who would later be identified as Daniel, wasn't able to speak. He was able to motion his hands in a shooting position to imitate that he'd been shot. When the chief asked him if someone else had shot him, he shook his body to the best of his ability to say no. The chief looked behind Daniel to see a pool of blood that turned into connecting drops, making its way into the home. As he walked deeper inside, he saw the lifeless body of Leslie on the floor. Once more, the chief recognized her immediately. He didn't need to ID her at all. Leslie laid on her back with her hands in her pockets of her jacket. the .357 pistol was laying not too far from her. Now, what I didn't mention before about this .357 Magnum pistol is that it's a gun that isn't easy to just accidentally go off. See, and not to give too much of a history lesson regarding firearms, although this is important. To understand gun safety, we must understand guns. See, different gun triggers can be easier or more difficult to squeeze. In this case, the .357 is a hard trigger to squeeze, meaning that it takes some force if you're going to discharge it. So it's kind of hard to do that by accident. Usually, if you're pulling that trigger, it's for a reason. It isn't like the guns that are used at an arcade or even a BB gun for that matter. Chief Turner looked at Leslie's hands in her pockets. She didn't have anything to do with this. If anything, she was caught off guard. Was this really an accident? Chief Turner's suspicions on the man outside in the driveway began to change. There was no sign of a break-in or enter. In fact, it was clear early on that Daniel did this. Also, during his rehabilitation, he admitted to it. The question was, why? Chief Turner began to investigate this crime, and that started by speaking to the ones closest to Leslie to get a better understanding of their relationship. It was revealed that Leslie's adoption came from a harrowing story. Leslie's father had shot her mother in their backyard and then turned the gun on himself. Leslie, at the age of 2, had seen the entire thing. Her adoptive family was determined to give her a new life. Leslie's sister, Susan, recalls that Leslie was this boisterous, warm person, and that didn't change in 2001 when she and Mike divorced. She'd spent the next 3 or 4 years dating and learning what she liked and didn't like. Most times, Susan and friends recalled any guy that Leslie dated would get to know those around her. They all would get together and have a good time. But with Daniel, things went differently. He was younger than her by about a decade. It is never clear how the two met, but what did become apparent was that Leslie would leave over the period of the 5 or 6 years that they were together. As in, they'd break up and make up, and most times Leslie left because the relationship had volatile components to it. Daniel had threatened her multiple times. He'd say, "I will take you out and I'll shoot myself. You'll end up the same way your parents did." He'd threatened her with a knife, and when it came to guns, there was a time when Leslie moved out and he literally had a gun on his lap and sat and watched her pack. And that move to Fort Benton, it's starting to feel like Leslie moved and that Daniel really did follow. And by follow, I mean refusing to let her truly be away from him. So remember how I said Leslie had seemed to appear on Thanksgiving Day after an hour or so away? Daniel had claimed that she fought with her daughter Amanda. But in reality, it was Daniel who Leslie had argued with, and she'd gone to her sister's house to decompress and discuss. Leslie was upset that Daniel had decided that Thanksgiving was going to be with his family, not with hers, isolating her again. Leslie had planned to leave, and Leslie was planning to go to the apartment to tell Daniel to pack his things and go. She was tired of this relationship. Daniel was controlling. He started arguments with her, and she was ready to be free from him once and for all. Susan asked Leslie to stay, at least for dinner, but she refused. Leslie was going to handle this. We've been in situations with our friends where we try to give advice, and anyone who knows someone who's in an abusive relationship knows that it may take them multiple times to decide and be able to finally leave. The guilt Susan must have felt, it had to have been so heavy. But the thing is, we can only try to support our loved ones in these situations. The guilt Susan is carrying, I hope she knows, that it has nothing to do with her. It's not her fault. It was Daniel that pulled that trigger. 2 hours after leaving Susan's home, Leslie was dead in her apartment. It was Leslie's children that had more to say about their relationship. A relationship that they had been front row in seeing. They explained that Leslie had gotten along with their dad, even post-divorce, but it was when he died that Leslie seemed to accelerate her relationship with Daniel. The two moved in a month after Mike's passing. Leslie was apparently infatuated with Daniel in the beginning. Things were even okay for a little bit, But a couple of months in, Kaylee, Leslie's youngest daughter, specifically saw arguments get physical. Daniel at this point was a heavyset man. He towered over the children and Leslie. He would push her, hit her, scratch her. Leslie had bruises constantly. And in the beginning, she would try to cover for him. Or she'd leave and eventually come back. Daniel would take advantage constantly, emotionally and physically abusing Leslie in front of her children. They described it as a never-ending cycle. That is, until it did end in a horrific fashion. Mark Billiard was the lead investigator on this case, and he would decide, was this an accident, a crime in the moment, like a split decision, or was it premeditated? Initially, Daniel was unable to make a formal statement, but it eventually was clear that he didn't have to, because Daniel had a handwritten statement, a note in his pocket, in lieu of being officially formally interviewed. It was on a napkin, and it read, "For the record, Leslie has thought about suicide for some time now. She has asked me to end her life several times. She has also asked me to be abusive to her so she could call the police for her own personal vengeance. I feel horrible for striking back at her. I have been pushed to that point. Never once have I done this in my life, and I never will again." Yeah, that's really what the note says. As it turns out, he wrote this note on the day of the shooting. The exact pen was found in his car. Investigators realized that Daniel had shot Leslie, went to his car, and wrote the note, then went on to shoot himself. This wasn't a note of remorse or admission. This was a note with a way out and reasoning. He could have used that time to get help, but he didn't. He let Leslie bleed out while he sat in the car, planning. So was this premeditated or a shocking planned afterthought? 2 months post the murder, Daniel laid in a hospital bed with a tube in his throat, still unable to speak. When police came in to interview him, he wrote on a separate page what happened. This story was much different than the napkin. Granted, he had 2 months to think it over. But according to Daniel, the gun just went off. It was an accident. In fact, he doesn't mention the napkin note or Leslie's alleged suicidal thoughts. Which, by the way, there were no signs or evidence of Leslie being suicidal. Nothing from family, friends, anything in the home that would have pointed to that. Amanda, Leslie's oldest daughter, explained that Daniel was intimidated by her. He was threatened by their bond and knew that Amanda was the closest to convincing her mother of leaving. So what if that was the argument, or alleged argument, I should say? What if it was Amanda pushing her mother to leave? Maybe those fights Daniel claimed occurred was more so about Amanda wanting her mother to get away from Daniel once and for all. Amanda explained that on that Thanksgiving day, the plans were that Leslie was supposed to meet Amanda and her brother Justin for dinner at the Golden Corral. In fact, all of Leslie's kids were there. Leslie that day called Amanda to explain that she may be late, that she was fighting with Daniel when the line suddenly went dead. Before Amanda's panic could set in, Leslie called back again to say that Daniel had struck her. Amanda said that she was coming to get her mom. But Leslie insisted that she was fine, that she'd leave the house on her own. To note, Daniel's version claimed that they were going to have the night to themselves, despite Leslie having 4 children and a sister in town. However, from both Susan and Amanda, Leslie had plans with her family and to see them at one point on Thanksgiving. Amanda said that she told her mother she loved her and that Leslie said, "I love you more." And that was the last time she had heard from her mother. When Amanda and the family finished their meal, they figured they'd see their mom later that night. Amanda went home and realized her sister Kaylee was calling repeatedly. Now, as older sisters are one to do, we gear up for something, maybe slightly annoyed, a tone only a sibling can give another one. But it was Chief Turner on the other end, not Kaylee, explaining that Leslie, Amanda's mother, had been murdered. Leslie died with her hands in her jacket pocket, her car outside was running, which means Leslie was leaving. If anything, leaving and giving Daniel time to pack his things and go. In the documentary Killer Cases, Leslie's children listened to Daniel's version of events. And they confirm it was a lie. That hunting trip wasn't true. It couldn't have been. Leslie had picked up her daughter Kaylee that morning. How could she be doing that if she was supposedly out hunting? Moreover, why go hunting, then come home and play with a gun? In the documentary, Daniel says he puts the gear away. But in the written confession, outside of the napkin confession, he claims that Leslie put the rifles away. Regardless of who put the guns away, why was there a .357 Magnum pistol left out? The siblings also confirmed that there wasn't an argument, that Amanda had gotten a call from Leslie saying that Dan hit her. Kaylee would explain that what happened behind closed doors, the way Daniel treated Leslie, was destructive and abusive. That it was much worse than the inklings that other family members or friends saw. The trial itself was broken down like this, according to Justia.com. Daniel was convicted of deliberate homicide and given life without parole, plus 10 years. From the investigator's testimony, a jury convicted Daniel John Paulsrud of deliberate homicide with a dangerous weapon on March 16, 2011. The 12th Judicial District Court, Chateau County, sentenced Daniel to 110 years in the Montana State Prison without the possibility of parole. The Chateau County attorney charged Daniel with deliberate homicide with a dangerous weapon for the death of his girlfriend, Leslie Davidson, in an incident that took place on Thanksgiving Day, November 26, 2009. Daniel and Leslie had a turbulent 6-year relationship in which Daniel threatened to kill Leslie and himself in a murder-suicide patterned after Leslie's biological parents' deaths. Leslie attempted to get out of their relationship several times because Daniel was physically abusive and controlling, traits that were triggered when he drank excessively. After receiving a call from a citizen, the Fort Bend Police Chief John Turner found Daniel on his hands and knees on the street outside of the apartment complex. Daniel had a self-inflicted gunshot wound to his face and jaw and could not talk. Chief Turner found Leslie's lifeless body inside of the apartment with a bullet wound to the chest. Leslie still had her glasses on and her hands in her pockets. At the sentencing, the state recommended that Daniel be sentenced to 100 years in the Montana State Prison for deliberate homicide, plus 10 years for the use of a dangerous weapon, to run consecutively, and that Daniel's parole eligibility be restricted. Daniel's attorneys argued against the parole restriction, recommending a sentence of 70 years, plus 10 years with the weapons enhancement, with 20 years suspended. Before imposing the sentence, the district reflected that there was no clear reason Daniel couldn't be rehabilitated, but that his conduct had been egregious with no justification whatsoever and no mitigating circumstance. Quote, "You used a large caliber handgun and purposely or knowingly pointed it at her, and without warning or provocation, you literally blew her away, needlessly and reprehensibly, snuffing out her life." Daniel has tried to appeal, but that has been continuously denied. Daniel explained that the note on the napkin was a drunken stupor. He denies killing Leslie deliberately and then wrote the letter. Daniel was not able to speak at his trial due to his injuries. He was essentially incoherent during the entire trial. According to Daniel's friends, he was kind, but also shocking that he could have anything to do with this. He knew how guns worked. In their opinion, he takes responsibility, but there are more questions than answers. The scariest thing is when you first meet Daniel, in his interviews, I mean. You kind of feel sorry for the guy. He's almost likable. Most sociopaths are. They learn to mirror. I researched this case before watching the documentary on it and realized that the nice guy thing was an act. Because there are holes, small telltale signs where his mask slips. The way he spoke of Leslie's children, moving her to that 43-person town. Moments like that, which just didn't feel right. Daniel wrote a letter to Amanda 5 years after his incarceration for prison. In the letter, he starts off by saying, It is difficult to put into words everything I need to say to you without fear of provoking that hate and disdain so common in your character. All I have ever known of you is hostility, alcoholism, and your trouble with the law. Daniel is writing this from prison after killing Leslie, drinking, and turning a gun to himself. The rest of the letter is an attempt to apologize while putting the blame on everyone else. Daniel believes that he and Leslie would still be together had she not died. He denies the murder being intentional. Daniel Paulsrud is in the Montana State Prison, where he will live out the rest of his days. Leslie would have been 65 years old. I'd imagine she'd still be bowling. She would get to meet all of her grandchildren and spend time with her children and her sister and brother. The relationship, from all accounts, was abusive, and from what it seems, Leslie was getting out and getting away. To live the life she truly deserved with her family and friends that loved her. Her children are adults now and live what seem to be private lives, focusing on their families and each other, and most of all, healing. Leslie would be proud. If you know anyone dealing with domestic violence, the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-7233. Love shouldn't hurt. Thank you all for joining me today. Our true crime fact of the episode is more along the lines of the discussion regarding gun violence. More than 40,000 people have been killed in gun-related deaths in 2023. Gun violence is real, with permanent consequences. As we continue this holiday season, please hold your loved ones close. Tell them how much they mean to you. Don't take this life for granted. And to anyone dealing with loss, especially during the holiday season, I'm sending you so much love and light. As always, follow me on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you all so much for joining me today. I've had a bit of a day, so being here with you means a lot to me. Covering this case means a lot to me, so just thank you. I'm taking a bit of a break from Instagram again. I get a little bit comparison-y, and I also just don't like being on social media like that. It just gets weird to me, so it may be a bit dark for a while, but that's okay. I do check Facebook from time to time. Please rate me 5 stars, tell your friends, leave a lovely comment. They make my day. And all of my sources will be on YvonneEstelle.com. Oh, did I also mention, follow me at YvonneEstelle True Crime and at YvonneEstelle. Yeah, follow me. With that being said, if I don't see you, have a safe and happy holiday. I'm giving you the biggest virtual hug. Please go check out something soft and loving and mind-numbing after this case. I am talking to you, my super true crime addicts. And have a safe journey. Keep walking in the light. Until next time, with love, YvonneEstelle.